I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. After 4 months in office, Kansas Governor Jeff Collier has decided he wants to keep his job. In the August primaries, we'll find out if voters feel the same way. Today, Collier will talk about the priorities his administration has addressed since he assumed office. We'll also discuss the biggest challenges facing Kansas and the governor's election campaign. Then we'll turn to Kansas native and currently the fifth best ranked U.S. president ever. That's Dwight Eisenhower. More than a golf-loving chief executive, we'll learn what he did behind the scenes to earn his place among America's top presidents. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. More than 4 months into his tenure as Kansas governor, Jeff Collier has made his presence felt. Lawmakers of both parties have described him as approachable, friendly, and willing to listen. On key issues, including school funding, his leadership has been viewed as a welcome departure from his predecessor, Sam Brownback. Not that it's been easy. The state budget remains a stiff challenge. The Kansas Supreme Court is expected to demand that lawmakers come back to Topeka this summer to increase spending on public schools, and there are ongoing issues with children's services and state prisons. Governor Jeff Collier joins us now for his first appearance on Up to Date. And Governor, so good to have you here. Welcome to Up to Date.
It's good to see you, Steve.
You were lieutenant governor for more than 7 years, so you were able to get a pretty good sense of what being governor was all about. But how has the job surprised you?
You know, it's been a wonderful time. I've had a great time. What has been really fantastic is that Kansans want to work with you. I've been talking to folks from all sides of the aisle, from all stripes, and everybody knows I'm a Ronald Reagan conservative, but we're going to work together. Mm-hmm. And I'm just very proud of the honor to be there and to have Kansans be willing to work with us. And I think you can see that we're starting to get some things done.
What was the biggest adjustment you had to make?
The biggest adjustment actually was probably less for me than for the staff, and that is they had to get used to surgeon time rather than politician time.
Meaning?
Meaning that a lot of times our days will start at 6:30 in the morning and we'll be home at 10:30 at night. And we really wanted to be out and be around the state, and that's just how I operate. So it's been a very busy time for us.
You're going hard, it sounds like.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Have you moved into Cedar Crest, the governor's mansion, you and Ruth, your wife?
Yeah. Ruth and I, we spend a few nights there, usually during the week and most weekends in Kansas City. But a lot of times I'm traveling around. It kind of depends on what the schedule looks like then. Haven't really had time to pack up our bags and actually physically move in.
Now, I know you have a medical career. Is that on hold so that you can devote full time to the governorship, or where does that stand with you right now?
You know, a lot of people have two jobs. They're working hard. I cut my medical practice 90% on that. So what I'm basically doing is a little bit of call and some things. So I was on call yesterday for some burns on Sunday. But I spend 100 hours a week on this job, and I love it.
You know, how tough was it watching the state rear up against the policies of Governor Brownback? I mean, you're a friend of his. You stood by him as the longest serving lieutenant governor in state history. And residents, you know, essentially ran him out of Kansas on a rail.
I don't think they ran him out on a rail, but there was clearly a disagreement over the tax policy. And that was overruled by the legislature. I think where we are in Kansas, though, is we want to look forward rather than look backwards. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things was one of my very first days, the second day I was in office, I was in Salina. And Carolyn in Salina at a coffee shop, she says, you know, in your car, there's a reason the rear view mirror is small and the windshield is big. Hmm. You know, you need to look forward. And what I'm interested in doing is, where are we going as a state? We're in an entirely different position than we were just a couple of years ago.
You didn't speak out against any of his policies. Obviously, you were his lieutenant governor, but talk to us about that. Why not?
You know, your job as lieutenant governor is to advise the governor on where you agree and disagree and to keep that counsel there. I think, many vice presidents, they serve at the pleasure, of the president, and likewise with the lieutenant governor. Sam has taken some of my ideas into account, but where we're going is what I'm interested in.
You've been in touch with him?
Yeah, talked to him a few weeks ago, and he had just come back from Bangladesh. That position is incredibly sensitive. If you think about it, every conflict in the world has a religious component to it, and he's really taking that job up.
Kansas Governor Jeff Collier is my guest. Let's turn to a big issue that's still before the state governor, and that's school funding. The betting line in Topeka is that the state Supreme Court is going to conclude sometime soon here that lawmakers didn't add enough money to the school funding formula and that more needs to be added. That could mean calling lawmakers back to Topeka for a special session in the weeks to come. If a court calls for more spending, even after the more than $500 million approved over 5 years just a few weeks ago by lawmakers, would you support that move from the court?
You know, this lawsuit, I think people need to have a little bit of perspective on this. This lawsuit's been going on for more than 50 years. I'm the 10th governor under this. Five Democrats, five Republicans. I think it's time that we get this behind us and get this into a more normal course. I think the legislature put together with us and in both a bipartisan fashion, we put together $535 million over the next 5 years to go into education. I think that is a truly good faith effort. What it does is it allows us to stair step money in so that the schools can actually use it, get it integrated in. Then it also, the big thing that I added into is I wanted outcomes. I want that every school gets a grade and that the school board looks at that.
Right.
So I think those big parameters are something that the court will take a look at. What they rule, I don't know. And I would probably, presume that this is not the last of it. I'm not that naive. But I think that this is a very strong step forward. And then we will deal with any of these issues. As a surgeon, when problems come up, you deal with them. And we will.
If the court says 535 was a good faith effort, but you need $700 million, Governor, do you call lawmakers back?
Depends on what the court says. The ability to put more money, on June 30th or July 1st, schools are only starting a month away there. The ability to adequately use that money in this school year would be tough for schools to be able to put that in.
Mm-hmm.
This year, there's going to be more than $200 million more going into K-12 education this year. I hope that money is being used in the classroom so that it helps on teacher pay. We increase teacher pay. We have more teachers, that we focus money on classroom learning and start looking at those outcomes. And those final decisions are made on the local school board level.
Right.
But we're working with folks, and I believe that we can really focus on it.
Just to be clear here, I'm going to push you here a little bit on this. Is there a chance if the court comes back and says 535 wasn't quite enough, you need to go further down the field here. If you disagree with that order, is there a chance you might say, we're not going to call them back, we're going to stand with what we've got?
I laid out some principles that said that we're not going to allow schools to be closed in Kansas. I think that's important for us. I also laid out that we need to have outcomes.
In fact, you said you will not stand by and watch the schools be closed.
That was
priority number one for
you. Correct.
Pretty close to that.
That's right. And, I believe that we're probably in a very good position where we're not going to have to see schools closing. But, if it takes, it may be that the people of Kansas may need to vote on this sometime on a constitutional amendment. We can do that.
You favor a constitutional amendment that would say, hey, school funding should be the purview of the legislature only and the Supreme Court should have nothing to do with it.
Let's see what this next ruling looks like and where they come out, because I believe the purview is of the legislature and the governor on what the amounts are. But if we need to have the people speak on that, but we're following the rule of law and we're going to continue to move forward, on that. And I see this as schools are an investment in the state of Kansas and not a burden. And one of the things, though, is I see a lot of reforms that we can be doing in schools, and we're starting to do those. One of those is we really need to be ready for the jobs of tomorrow. And that means in schools that we have different education. So, for example, many more opportunities to get a certificate, whether it's a welder or a CNA certificate. Those are jobs of the future and where people can get high-paying jobs right now. Also, though, looking at how do we make sure that our reading and math outcomes, those are up to par.
Well, if I understand correctly, the state Supreme Court is saying by its rulings that not enough money is being spent, that the schools today aren't preparing our kids to a level that they think is adequate, and that's why this money has to get spent. I mean, in a sense, you and the court are agreeing here.
Sure. We are putting more money in, but I want to make sure that that money gets into the classroom, and that's really important, that it gets where it's needed.
Is it fair to conclude that the state is still dramatically underfunding schools? Because a consultant's report said exactly that just a few months ago.
There are a lot of consultants' reports out there.
But this is the one that the Kansas Republican-dominated legislature hired to look at it.
That's correct. Now, what the legislature looked at and we looked at was something that's a pretty good faith effort. And that report was actually suggesting over multiple years, over a decade, maybe even two decades. I think what we do is we're putting the money in, we make sure that we have outcomes, and let's see what we get. I want us to really make sure that we're having outcomes, particularly for the bottom quarter of students across the country or across the state. And how do you improve schools? You know, part of this also is the reform. We have a new program going on called Kansans Can. And what that does is they are reinventing the classroom from the classroom up in several different school districts. Seven school districts are doing it at first. They're the Gemini 7. And then now we're looking at expanding that dramatically so that a school district or a school building can say, all right, what time does our classroom start? What are we teaching? What's in this? And how does this relate to our jobs? I brought in and created a Governor's Education Council so that we look at this as a long-term issue. And that Governor's Education Council is working with legislators and with businesses of where are our jobs going to be in the future here? You know, right now we have 50,000 open jobs in the state of Kansas, and our unemployment rate's 3.6. What we really need, if anything, it's not that we have unemployment. It is that we're underemployed. And how do we move our skill set up across the state? I think there are some tremendous things that we can do there that a lot of it is reorienting where schools are going and teaching and working with that local school district on how to best see the outcomes. I want to see our kids stay in Kansas.
The legislature this year, Governor, considered yet another tax cut, this one totaling about $200 million over 3 years, but ultimately walked away from it. Those who supported it said it was the right thing to do, you know, as a response to changes in the federal tax code that will result in a revenue boost to the state. Did you support that cut? Was that a good idea?
Yeah, I would have signed that bill. And in fact, on Friday, we just got our new collections for the month of May.
And revenue's up.
And revenue's up $100 million. And here's the other thing is not only are revenues up, but we're holding our expenses down overall. We're trying to become more efficient, putting money where we belong. And Standard & Poor's, just a couple of weeks ago, for the first time in years, raised our credit outlook. I think in the long run is low taxes, low regulation, but solid regulation, but low tax, low regulation, a well-educated workforce, and those Kansas values, I think that really puts us in a place where we can go. I think you'll see us looking at taxes next year as the year goes on.
Hey, do you think, speaking of taxes, did Governor Brownback go too far? Did he sign a tax cut that the state ultimately couldn't afford, Governor?
You know, where we are now, I'm not really interested in relitigating the past here.
But it's living with us today.
But where we are today is we're financially stable. We're paying our bills. The legislature overruled the governor on it. There are a lot of additional things that are happening. The Trump economy is helping. Being able to improve our skill sets in the state actually helps people raise their income. I think where we're going is the real question.
Will you say whether he went too far or not?
You know, for me, what I, you know, I think the judgment of many people is that he did. And some of us that, and many of us have said, no, we didn't. The bill that was that's ultimately
your feeling
his,
that he did not.
You know, but I trust where people are now. And we've been, there are a whole lot of things that happened that there. It was not just taxes. It was, you know, the oil and gas going down. The price of wheat, you know, dropped by more than 50%. We've
the
got real
industry,
challenges.
The aviation industry didn't do us any favors either. Yeah.
And, you know, but now where we're going is I think we can lower taxes, make them simpler overall, and meet our obligations. I want to make sure we're growing our state. And I think if we play our cards from where we are today, that's what I'm interested in, where we are today, if we play our cards pretty straight over the next 5 years or so, we can be in a pretty good position.
Kansas Governor Jeff Collier is my guest here. You said something interesting the other day, Governor, when you filed for office. You said you want the upcoming campaign for governor, I'm quoting here, to bring out the best in Kansans. What did you mean by that?
You know, I really believe that Kansas is the true heart of America, and I think most Kansans believe that too. I think we're in this very special place where we serve our neighbors, we work with them, you know, and we have to make some hard decisions, and we do. And that's the very special thing about Kansans. And I think in this campaign as we're going forward, you can have a campaign that is very noisy, or you can have one that, yes, people get to see what the issues are and they get to decide and have the input and make those decisions in a very reasonable manner, in a very calm manner, like Kansans like to do.
You want to have a conversation, not an argument?
That's right.
You've been noticeably reluctant to attack your main rival for the GOP nomination, that's Secretary of State Kris Kobach. How come?
You know, I'm interested in telling people and getting people to know, here's what I'm about and where we're going as a state. And so I want people to know that they have a governor who's going to listen to them, who's going to work with them. They also have a governor that they know where he's coming from. I started out working for Bob Dole and then worked for President Ronald Reagan. So you know where I'm coming from. And I believe in the optimism of Kansas and in our future prospects. For me, how that works is let's get things done. And that's what I'm focusing on. And you know what? I share a lot of credit with people. I think people like, they're going to get the chance to see how their governor is operating. And that's what it's about.
Let me take this a step further. Some say, and you've heard this before, that you can't win this race if you refuse to be more aggressive against a candidate who's rarely reluctant to be aggressive. What do you say to that?
You know, I'm a surgeon. I'm very aggressive at the right time. And I think you have to be very appropriate at that. What we're doing, though, is we've been out listening to Kansans, you know, keeping surgeons' hours, not politician hours, and getting things done, fixing school finance, making sure that we have low regulations, arguing against Planned Parenthood and getting that before the United States Supreme Court, being a strong protector of the Second Amendment. And by getting those things done, I think Kansans get to see what we're about. And it's working. You know, in the polls, they show us a couple points ahead.
Well, let me see if this is one of those moments you want to be aggressive, because over the weekend, Kris Kobach was in a parade in Shawnee here in Johnson County, in which he was standing in a Jeep next to a gun mounted in the truck that looked like a 50-caliber machine gun, Governor. It turned out to be a replica, in fairness to the Secretary of State. But there was enough of an outcry over it that the city issued an apology. What do you make of it, and what do you make of what he did and the decision to do what he did?
You know, I'm going to let Kris answer why he did what he did. Let me tell you what I did on Saturday.
Well, do you have a problem with what he did?
You know, for me, it is how you want to present yourself, that's your choice. And if that's how he wants to present himself, that's his choice, and he can take the consequences of that and the advantages if he perceives them there. But let me tell you what I did on Saturday. On Saturday morning, early morning, I started out with about 100 Kansas National Guardsmen and then another couple hundred of
Governor,
their family.
Let me come back at you here. Just to be clear, Kris Kobach's in a parade in Shawnee, Kansas. Yeah. Lots of little kids running around who increasingly are afraid of guns and what guns can do to them. Mm-hmm. He's in a parade going down a busy street with this 50-caliber machine gun next to him. What do you think of it?
I would never do that.
What did you think of him doing it?
You know, that's his choice. And if that's how he wants to do it, that's his choice.
What's your biggest concern if Kris Kobach becomes the governor of Kansas? Again, he's your chief rival for the GOP nomination in August. He espouses many of the same policies that Governor Brownback did. What's your biggest concern about him?
You know, for me, my biggest concern is I don't think he can win the general. I think we're in a position where you work with Kansas, you build on it, and you work for where today is. And I don't want to put the governorship of Kansas at risk. And being a good,
for the Republican Party
for
of
the
Kansas.
Republican Party of Kansas, mm-hmm. This is a very important election for us. This is where are we going as a state? And I think most Kansans want us to look forward. How are we going to be a state with low taxes, low regulation, but has great schools and has the jobs of the future right here? That's what this is about.
You know, with an independent on the ballot on November 6th, it's unlikely anyone will win a majority of the vote. How would you plan on governing with just a plurality of that vote? How would that change things?
You know, I think that we can win in November, and there's polling that shows that. From my perspective, you know, I think Kansas is a center-right state, and I intend to be myself and to govern, you know, from that. I think you can build a very strong coalition, even in a three-way race, and have good legislative partners and a really good message here of low taxes, low regulations, great schools. I think you can build a consensus about that that all Kansans can follow.
Governor Jeff Collier of Kansas is my guest. We have him for a few more moments. We have a question here. What does it say about the state of our region? This is interesting that mm-hmm. Iowa, Kansas, and now Missouri are currently led by folks who once were lieutenant governors. What's going on out there?
You know, I don't know exactly what's going on out there, but there's been a lot of transition. I know those other two governors. I know Kim Reynolds very well. I've served with her as lieutenant governor. I know Mike Parson.
Up in Iowa.
In Iowa.
Mike Parson
in Missouri
now.
And we've seen some other lieutenant governors move. Part of that is the normal transition when you have a new president and they bring governors out. You know, your job as lieutenant governor is, you know, to learn, be there, and be the best advisor. And those are three very seasoned politicians who really want to reach out to folks. And I think they truly, well, I've talked to both of them. They truly appreciate the opportunity. They understand the difficulties that they have to face. And I think they're going to be up for the job.
You know, noting that I'm speaking to a former lieutenant governor, one big issue in Missouri is whether they fill the lieutenant governor post or not. There's legal scholars on both sides of that issue arguing vehemently over what's the right way to proceed here. How important is it for a state to have a lieutenant governor in your view?
Having a lieutenant governor is absolutely critical. Okay, you do not want to put yourself in a position where you have a constitutional crisis. You know, where there's not a clear line of authority and a clear line. Having a lieutenant governor who's elected, who can work with the governor and be there, I think that gives certainty, you know, to the voters should something happen.
You know, different topic. President Trump's trade war, Governor. How concerned are you about the impact this is going to have on Kansas farmers across the state?
You know, I've been very involved with this, and part of it is not so visible, and part of it is. China recently imposed a 179% tariff on sorghum. Kansas is the largest provider of sorghum. When that happened, I talked with the White House several times, United States Trade Representative, even brought in the Chinese Consul General.
Wow.
Was out visiting with farmers across the state.
They're worried.
And they were worried. And because we want everybody to know that we are a stable trading partner, we're a good supplier, and that we have the best quality. And when we brought in the Chinese Consul General, and the administration was also negotiating with them, we support, you know, the president in his negotiations. You know, we don't like, you know, if it hurts us there. But what happened in the end was the Chinese backed down on that 2 weeks ago. I think that's a real win. We're going to have these trade issues for the next couple of years, but we need to make sure that we have open and fair markets, and there will be some tough negotiations.
Given that, is President Trump doing the right thing, Governor?
You know, I think President Trump is bringing a new way of doing it that people aren't used to, that negotiating style.
Right.
And I think he's gained some things done.
Let's turn to kids. I mean, there's been a lot of concern that the state isn't doing enough to protect children in state custody or even kids in danger in their own homes. How satisfied are you with the progress that your new Secretary of Children and Family Services, Gina Meyer-Hummel, is making in this area? She's been here before. What do you make of her work?
You know, it's been really good to have a professional like Gina come in. There have been a huge number of challenges in this division. You know, our kids and those in foster care and adoption are absolutely critical. And we have an obligation to keep them safe and to make sure that we find them a home. And we try to find them a forever home or reunite a family and try to also prevent those family splits. When I brought in Gina Meyer-Hummel, what we've done since then is we've replaced the entire leadership of the agency down into regional offices. We're in the process right now of a top-to-bottom review, and we're working with the legislature on this. There's a task force that's out there that's giving us good things. But then also, though, we're actively trying to be involved on a daily basis. We got additional $15 million just to help us make sure. You know, one of the things that we inherited is that sometimes kids were sleeping in the offices.
And they still are, Governor. I was going to raise that point. Yeah.
And they still are. The money doesn't come in until July 1st. Now, we've already been able to cut back that number some, but we're actually in visiting each of those offices, and we're having, you know, a social worker. We're hiring new social workers and additional folks so we can take care of this problem. And we're going to, and here's one other thing though, Steve, is we're going to be tenacious about this. This is not something that you just do a couple of things and then it's over with. This is going to take years, and this is a priority for state government, and it's a core function that we're going to deal with, and we're going to have continuous improvement on it.
You know, in the late 80s, this was an issue. Kansas's foster care system was an issue. You mentioned how far back school litigation mm-hmm. goes. This has been an issue, too. One final point here before you go. You signed into law a measure that allows faith-based adoption agencies to continue to get state funding for placement services, even if they turn away prospective parents on religious grounds. Why did you sign it?
You know, the system that we have right now is we need more providers. We need more foster homes, more adoption homes in the state of Kansas.
Critics says though this new law might turn more parents away.
Well, actually, the way that the situation is that we had right now before this law came in is you had organizations such as Catholic Charities, which brought in largely families of faith and many other, there are many other organizations that they were drawing in from families of faith. We have other organizations that are more secular, and they bring in families that they reach out to through businesses or through social organizations or through different communities. And both of those are really helping us get there. And I think everybody would agree that today, that before this bill was signed, that we were really trying to cover all the bases. What that bill did is it preserved the status quo that everybody can be in. Otherwise, you will end up losing, you know, do we really want to lose one of our largest providers who've been providing tremendous services for 70 years in the state of Kansas? I think a situation where there's a live and let live is a pretty good compromise.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Kansas Governor Jeff Collier. Governor, very nice to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
Great.
Time for a break. When we come back, you aren't going to believe this, but the fifth all-time ranked president in U.S. history, right after Washington and Lincoln, that man is Dwight D. Eisenhower of Kansas. We'll find out why. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. We are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week on the program, Missouri Attorney General Josh Hawley and U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill gave us their thoughts on Governor Greitens resigning and the U.S. Senate race. Hear that conversation and many others at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we begin our series on U.S. Representative Kevin Yoder's Democratic challengers for his seat in the House. You can join us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Dwight Eisenhower is on the rise. In a C-SPAN survey of historians last year, it was Dwight Eisenhower, the man raised in Abilene, Kansas, who ranked as our fifth greatest president, up from ninth in 2000. The rise is due to what historians call a reassessment of the way Eisenhower navigated a series of crises in the 1950s that included McCarthyism, the Cold War, and turmoil around civil rights. It's a record worthy of reconsideration, which is exactly what historian William Hitchcock has done with a new book, The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. William Hitchcock is a professor of history at the University of Virginia and the author or editor of six previous books. He's going to discuss his new book and President Eisenhower on Wednesday evening at the Truman Library and Museum, but he joins us now by phone. Professor Hitchcock, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks very much, Steve. Good to be with you.
So there's been this reassessment of President Eisenhower, Will. What's caused this to happen?
Well, you know, presidents and their reputations do tend to go through ups and downs. We've always had a kind of top three or top four, Washington, Lincoln, and the two Roosevelts, Franklin and Teddy Roosevelt. But Eisenhower's usually been in the top 10, but maybe just around 10 or 9. But suddenly he looks different, and I think it is has a lot to do with, first of all, the sense that Eisenhower, as president, was a man who drew his support from Democrats and Republicans. And today, in a very polarized climate, I think there is still a large number of Americans who yearn for a time when the president could be somewhat above party and could bring Americans together, act as a unifying figure. Obviously, his policies at the time now also look wise. He kept us out of war, ended the Korean War. We stayed out of Vietnam in the 50s when he was president. He balanced the budget. He was a small government conservative with respect to finances. But maybe the number one reason why he looks so good now is his personal moral authority. He was a dignified, trusted figure that most Americans admired enormously before he became president and then while he was president and even afterwards. So he just has one of those men whose personal story was so appealing and so attractive, and he remains enormously popular in the public memory today.
I was going to say, when you set out to do this book, was it your intention to explain why he should be one of our most revered presidents?
No, not at all. I didn't have any particular desire to prove a point that Ike should be number 5 or number 4 or number 25 or anything like that. I did want to figure out what made him tick? What was his leadership style? What can we learn from his leadership style that we might apply today? I was curious about, you know, what makes a president effective? What makes him consequential? A lot of people do have the misimpression that Ike just basically played a lot of golf and sort of delegated things while he was president, and that's a total myth. The 1950s was a very tumultuous and in many ways a dangerous time, and his management style was very effective in heading off some of the more dangerous crises.
But that's the myth that's sort of setting concrete out there, that he's something or was something of a lightweight. How did that view of Eisenhower, you know, become the thinking to the extent that it is? Because historians ranking the president shortly after he left office ranked him, 22nd of 31 chief executives at the time. He was right up there with good old Chester Arthur and the impeached Andrew Johnson.
I know. It's quite a recovery for Eisenhower.
Yes.
We also have to remember, so in the early 60s, when historians were polled in that famous poll that was done, it ranked Eisenhower very, very low. Almost all those historians were actually Democrats, and we know that because the poll was organized by a Harvard professor named Arthur Schlesinger.
Arthur Schlesinger,
Senior.
Sure.
Yeah, and he was the father of the famous Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who was Kennedy's speechwriter. So the fix was in a little bit, and that's really the point, is that Eisenhower's reputation took a lot of hits from the Kennedy era. And John Kennedy, who Americans fell in love with because he was young and he was bright and articulate and charming and funny and also, in many respects, a wise president, he set himself up as the anti-Eisenhower. He said, look, I'm young, Eisenhower is old. I'm bright, Eisenhower is dull. I want to have, you know, intellectuals surrounding me in the White House. Eisenhower went and played golf with his business friends. And Kennedy really, really went at this really hard. Actually, in the 1960 election, he sort of ran against Eisenhower rather than against Vice President Nixon. And I think that really hurt Ike's reputation. And ever after, the generational divide between Kennedy and Ike was always, it worked out to Eisenhower's sort of detriment. It took him a while. It took us to get through the Vietnam War period when people began to look back and say, wait a minute, Eisenhower didn't want to get involved in Vietnam. Maybe he was on to something. And it took us the impeachment of Nixon when people started to look back and say, hey, there were no scandals in the 50s. Maybe Eisenhower was on to something. And on it went. And throughout the 1980s and 90s, people began to reassess Eisenhower's style, which wasn't very flashy, but which was quite effective.
Historian William Hitchcock is my guest. His new book, The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. He'll be discussing Ike's legacy and the age of Eisenhower at 6:30 Wednesday evening at the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum in Independence. More information, TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. You declare in the prologue to this book, Will, that the end of World War II to the presidency of John F. Kennedy should be known now as the age of Eisenhower. Why not start that time even earlier during his years as the Supreme Allied Commander of World War II? And why declare the Harry Truman years in the White House as part of this age of Eisenhower?
Well, I'm really looking for a way to tell the story about what happens between two very active periods of Democratic leadership and activity. That's the Franklin Roosevelt period, the Great Depression and the New Deal, and World War II leadership. Franklin Roosevelt dominated American public life from the 30s to 1945, and the period of the 1960s when, with Kennedy and Johnson, you get a dramatic increase in the government role in public life and a variety of major legislative actions. A lot of people have seen the period in between as kind of a missed opportunity, not enough major legislation happened. And I'm trying to suggest that in that period, 45 to 1963, it's actually Eisenhower who shapes American public life. And he is actually far more effective in many ways than we might think, passing important legislation, but also framing American values in a way, bringing them into public view. He's a conservative on finance, but he's a liberal on social issues. Hmm. So he finds a compromise between the more progressive New Deal legacy of Roosevelt and the conservatives of the right in the Republican Party. He's a moderate, and he expands Social Security. He believes in infrastructure. He invests, of course, famously in the highway program. Mm-hmm. He invests in the space program. He invests in education, public schools, major infrastructure projects. So in a way, he blends together many of the things that Americans say they want. And he stands even today as an exemplar of that ability to have a balanced budget, yes, but also major government investment in things like security on the international sphere, but also important public projects at home. So a fascinating blend, I think, of the left and the right. And that's why I wanted to capture that sense in the title, Age of Eisenhower, of this moderateness. Now, Harry Truman, everyone in Kansas and Missouri loves Harry Truman, but he was a very partisan man.
Mm-hmm.
He liked a good fight.
Yes, he did.
He was a politician from his head to his toes, and of course it shaped his presidency. Truman was embattled, and he was combative. And at the end of his presidency, he was, unfortunately, if you're a fan, one of the lowest rated in terms of his popularity. His popularity was very, very low, and that's in part because he was so combative, and he turned everything into a personal fight. And in fact, he and Eisenhower really went at it
in 1952.
So
yeah.
Truman's a bit more prickly. Eisenhower managed to sort of figure out how to be more genial while he was in the White House.
You know, one thing that really struck me about your book is the extent to which Eisenhower did things behind the scenes. Give us some example of the things he did out of public view that we've only learned about recently due to the release of more records out of the Eisenhower Library in Abilene.
Right. Well, one example of him working behind the scenes that people have looked to in the past was how he tried to undercut Senator Joseph McCarthy working behind the scenes. Eisenhower didn't want to attack Senator Joe McCarthy, the great red hunter, directly, felt that that would end up hurting himself, hurting the presidency. It would make him look like he was descending into a gutter fight. But behind the scenes, he began with his advisors to put together some embarrassing information about Joe McCarthy's staff, his counselor, Roy Cohn, and they began to leak information about their behavior to the press. And that turned out to be sort of an example of how Eisenhower preferred to work, the indirect approach, if you like. He didn't like to get on the stump and say, I denounce that man, I denounce that guy. But he was willing to use the levers of power to do things somewhat behind the scenes so that the dirty work of politics didn't stick to him personally. That's rather different in many ways from Harry Truman. And another example is really the less appealing dimension of his time in office is the use of covert operations, mm-hmm. the expansion of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was founded and really expanded dramatically in the 1950s. Ike liked using secret covert operations because it was out of public view. He could deny knowing about it. But under his leadership, the CIA did a number of things. Guatemala, Iran, triggered a number of coups there and around the world. So that's perhaps a less appealing legacy of operating in secret to pursue national security goals.
Speaking of a less appealing part of his legacy, let's turn to civil rights, because this is complex and it'll take a few minutes to parse here, I think. You write that he was cautious on civil rights. He was wary, but he didn't obstruct progress. And I'm wondering if that record is good enough.
Well, people are going to disagree, and this is what historians do. We disagree with each other all the time and keep writing new books to make our arguments. Eisenhower's record on civil rights, I think, can best be described as much better than you would have predicted, better than expected. Now, that's not exactly a ringing endorsement. We're not going to transform him into a civil rights hero. But if you think about who he was, he grew up in Kansas in the turn of the century. He lived his career in a segregated U.S. military. Most of his friends were Southerners. He went to Augusta National for his weekends, which was a segregated golf club. So he didn't understand black life in America at all. And yet, despite that, there were a number of signature moves that he supervised while in office that I think stand as important milestones in the civil rights story. He helped to desegregate the capital city of Washington, D.C., right when he got into office. He appointed Earl Warren to the Supreme mm-hmm. Court, which meant that the famous decision of Brown versus Board of Education would come through the Supreme Court. Now, Eisenhower was a little ambivalent about it, but it wouldn't have happened without him. And that was the desegregation order that said, you know, public schools cannot be segregated on the basis of race.
I was going to say, how did he handle that ruling? Because obviously the landmark school deseg ruling that came out of Topeka, because at a news conference, Eisenhower once didn't exactly demonstrate strong backing of that decision, Will.
No, it's true, and people have debated what the significance of that was. He famously said, look, the press asked him, what do you think about the Brown versus Board decision? And he said, well, the Supreme Court has ruled, and I will obey. And it was perceived to be a cold, tepid endorsement of the decision. My own view is a little different. I put it into context. You know, that was a busy day. There were millions of other questions that came before him on that day, actually having to do with Joseph McCarthy. Mm-hmm. It was a passing remark. I don't think it meant that he was against the decision. But in fact, he was ambivalent, and he remained ambivalent on civil rights. He was genuinely afraid that the white South would react violently against the perception that the federal government was forcing them to desegregate. And guess what? He was right. The white South did react violently. And in 1955 and 56, many southern states closed public schools and launched the massive resistance campaign. Now, that tells you that the issue was burning and that Eisenhower was right to be cautious. But you could also criticize him for not going to battle more fully, more aggressively on behalf of civil rights.
Hey, how did he manage Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev? You conclude they had a fairly steady relationship. How so?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, think about it. Joseph Stalin, one of the worst dictators in the world, a mysterious tyrant, the man who'd murdered so many of his own people, he died in 1953, right at the beginning of Eisenhower's time in office. So When Eisenhower's president, he has no idea who the new Soviet leaders are going to be. Are they going to be little Stalins, or are they going to be more moderate, more open? And Eisenhower says, we've got to find out. So he tries to send signals that he's willing to talk. And in 1955, and again in 1959, Eisenhower meets with the new Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, and they disagree on just about everything, but it does suggest that Eisenhower believed in the importance of personal diplomacy. Reach out. Extend the hand of maybe not friendship, but at least understanding or diplomacy. And what's the worst that can happen? That was his view. And the result is, I think he moderated the tension of the Cold War somewhat in the late 50s. You know, Nikita Khrushchev came to the United States and visited the U.S. All across the country during Eisenhower's term in 1959, a hilarious episode of Khrushchev being a tourist in the United States. That was a big breakthrough, and it really moderated the Cold War a bit.
Well, just to wrap up here, I would guess that Dwight Eisenhower has reached his ceiling as the fifth all-time ranked president in U.S. history, judged by a C-SPAN panel of historians. Ahead of him are the two Roosevelts, a guy named Lincoln, and a man named Washington. I don't think you'll see him going much higher than five, do you?
No, I don't, and I think he'll probably float a little bit around there in the top 10, but it's just a reminder that we do, when we're really asked to think about it, we value dignity in office, we value experience, we value moderation, a sense of unifying the country. Those are things that people, I think, want to see in the White House, and perhaps we don't value intense partisanship. That's something that also unites most of the people on that list.
That's William Hitchcock. His new book, The Age of Eisenhower, America and the World in the 1950s. Again, you can see and hear Will Hitchcock Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Harry S. Truman Library and Museum out in Independence. More information, TrumanLibraryInstitute.org. Will, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
You bet. Tomorrow on the show, we talk with Democrats Tom Nierman and Mike McCammon about their bids to challenge Republican incumbent Kevin Yoder for his seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, Dallas Johnson, and Emily Park. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.